The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Good evening and welcome to The Parents Show here on Mix 92.6. Thanks for joining us. A couple of weeks ago was School Governors Awareness Day, and we thought we'd actually find out a little bit more about what school governors do. And to do that, Ian Pritchard spoke to Lucy Parr, who is the Chair of Governors at St Nicholas School, Harpenden.
So, if you have children, if you've been involved in schools at all, you will know that the role of governor at a school is quite important. And on the Parents Show, we have today Lucy Parr, who is the Chair of Governors at St Nicholas Church of England Primary School in Harpenden. So welcome, Lucy.
Thank you.
So let's jump in straight away and hear a little bit about St Nick's in Harpenden and the role of governor, and then we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty around that.
Well, St Nicholas is a relatively small primary school. It's a Church of England school right in the heart of Harpenden town, which is lovely, and originally a Victorian school, so we've been around a long time. And we're quite special. We're obviously closely connected to the church. We have a strong Christian ethos. We're right in the centre of the community, as I said. But we are only small. We have five classes across the 7 years that children are in primary school, which means we have mixed age classes, mm-hmm. which isn't unique, but is more of a rarity. There are other schools in our same position and schools that are even smaller than us.
So say a little bit about that, Lucy. How does that work if you've got mixed? Does that mean year one and year two are sitting in the same classroom being taught by the same teacher? How does it work?
There is some overlap. So it's one of the things that when we have our open days to introduce prospective parents to, we do a lot of explaining off, because it is something to get your head around, but it actually plays out really well, we find, in terms of how the children develop and how they can progress within their own education. So we have five classes, and for example, the bottom class will have all the reception children in, and some of the year one children. The other half of the year one children will be in the next class up with the year two children, and so it goes on until the top of the school, which is year six. The top class has all of the year six children and half of the year five children.
Right.
So it means that during their 7 years with us, every child will have 2 years of their education in the same class. So they might, as we say, repeat a class, but they're not repeating their education, because we've always been this way. We have very experienced staff who can teach children to their ability. And because we have that mixed ability in the class, it means that they can progress at their own level.
Nice.
And it also means that all children have a chance to be at the older end of their class and the younger end of their class, depending on which year they're in, which is great for helping to build confidence. It also helps them to get to know other children. Because we're only a small school anyway, we find that the children all get to know each other across the whole school. And of course, there's lots of siblings, and they get to know their siblings' friends.
And do the children move up according to age or ability, or is it a complicated?
So it is strictly according to age, because that's the fairest way to do it. There's an understanding that that's how it operates. And as I say, it gives children the chance to be older in the class or younger in the class.
Yeah.
It gives them sort of mentoring responsibilities. It builds their confidence if they're the older ones in the class. I had three children myself a few years ago now at St. Nicholas, and my son was young in the year. Both my daughters were older in the year. They all had a slightly different path in terms of which two classes they were in for 2 years. But my middle daughter in particular, who was quieter and shyer, when she ended up being at the older end of that class, it really helped build her confidence and used to get across, you know, all of the children. It's lovely.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes one of the parents' worries is that children will be split from their friends if, you know, these random divisions can happen. But we also work very hard across the school in terms of there are certain activities and certain teaching that the children still stay in their year groups for.
Yeah.
And also there are lunch times and playground time where they all get together, or class trips and year group trips. So it actually works really well. It's something quite different.
I'm sure. So Let's dip into the ethos at St. Nicholas in a few minutes. I can imagine there are some things that are a little bit different about being a faith school that St. Nicholas is being attached to St. Nicholas Church. But tell me some more about being a governor, first of all. How long have you been a governor? And what's actually, what does a governor do?
So personally, I've been a governor for just about 5 years, and I've had various roles across the board in that time. And then I've latterly become chair. So I've been chair of our board for just over a year. And the governors, we're all volunteers. We all give our time for free and for the love of the role. And it's very rewarding. And it can be really interesting. And actually, we all bring different skill sets to the role, but we all learn different skills as we go along, which is, it's lovely, actually. And we have, as a board, collectively, we have three key responsibilities. One is ensuring the clarity of vision and ethos of the school, whether that be a Christian school, as in our case, or otherwise, and particularly an oversight of the strategic direction. Another responsibility is holding the leaders to account for the educational performance of our pupils and also for the management of the staff. And then the third key role we have is overseeing the financial operation of the school and making sure the money is all well and wisely spent. So those are our sort of three key roles. And I would say, in terms of the relationship with the staff, one phrase that comes up a lot is we act as a critical friend. It's very important to remember that the governors are responsible for the overall strategic direction of the school, but the day-to-day operational management is very much the responsibility of the head of the school and the senior leadership team. So it's keeping that balance that we have an oversight, we can advise, we can support, we can ask challenging questions. I think that's one of the really key things, is to challenge decisions and to really probe why things are happening and if things can be different, just to give that element of critical friendship, as I say. But day to day, obviously, the head and the staff know the children the best. They know what's going on. They know how the teaching and the curriculum is working. So, but we're very closely involved, and particularly in a small school like we are at St. Nick's.
Absolutely. So some key areas of focus there, but nevertheless, quite a broad range of responsibilities. So how many governors are there at St. Nick's, and is that typical of schools?
Yes, it is. So we're a voluntary-aided, maintained school. So we have a classic, if you like, board of governors that operate purely within the school. So it's very different from an academy trust, for example, that has an overall board. So we have a board of governors specifically for St. Nicholas School, and we are 14 in total. And that includes the head teacher. So they are always one of the governors as well, and a staff governor. And then in terms of volunteers, because we are a faith school, a church school, we have 8 foundation governors, they're called, which includes the rector of our church. So they are ex officio, they're there by dint of their position. So for as long as we have a vicar or rector in tenure, they will be a governor. The other foundation governors, our typical term is for 4 years, and some governors will do one term of 4 years. Many do a second term, some do a third, which is fantastic. But I think often people do 2 terms because you feel like after you've put 4 years into a school and given your own time, you're actually just about trained up to really give something back. So a second term is great because you have a lot of very experienced governors, but equally it's good to have the turnover. But yes, sorry, I'm diversifying. We have 8 foundation governors. So one is the rector. 5 are appointed by the church PCC, the Parochial Church Council. So they're approved by them. And 2 others are approved by our Diocesan Board of Education, which is the church education office that's part of the diocese.
So obviously, you've got a particular composition among the governors that reflects the links with St. Nicholas Church. Would you expect to see a similar balance of governors in a school that wasn't faith-based?
Yes, I think the number and size of the board is generally similar, and you will always have parent governors, and you'll always have a head teacher and a staff governor. And I think the key thing ideally is to try and have a diversity on that board of men and women, of parents and non-parents, of people with different life experience and work experience. So as I say, it's a very broad brush, as you commented before, what we do as governors. So I think having a variety of skills is really key if you can achieve that. I know, you know, we're very fortunate at St. Nicholas. We have a full board of governors at the moment, and we've always managed to have that, you know, rolling over going forward as governors have stepped down and retired. We've always managed to recruit, which has been fantastic. And a lot of schools don't necessarily manage that, depending on who they have in their areas, whether there are people who are able to give the time necessary, because it does take a bit of time up. So normally the configuration of a board would be very similar, but it does depend from school to school and area to area how easy it is to fill all those positions. And obviously the burden can be greater if you've got quite a small number on your board. So we're very fortunate that we've got a full board of governors at the minute, which is fantastic.
Sure. Well, you mentioned time consuming there, and I want to know how much time does get consumed, what sort of things governors have to do, and how much of their lives it occupies. But you mentioned earlier as well training, and I was just thinking about that because obviously people coming to the role of governor, they're going to be lay people typically. I guess some of them might have been teachers at some point in the past, but generally speaking, they're going to be people who haven't been governors before. So what sort of training do governors get? Is it informal or is there a structure?
It is very structured. So obviously a lot of it is sort of learning on the job, and those who, often we have people who have had children go through the education process or got grandchildren going through the education process, or, you know, may not have children at all, but if everyone has been through school, so, you know, you understand, you're there because you understand the importance of that educational experience, both in terms of learning and in terms of development for children, and you have that interest. I think that is the key thing, to have an interest in the well-being of children and wanting to see their development and progress and do the best you can to support that. So getting to know your school, there'll be an induction process always. So when we recruit new governors, there's quite a lot of reading to do in terms of, you know, the background of the school and the curriculum and various policies. But we're lucky as well. There's a very structured training program that you can dip in and out of. So there are certain training packages that we require governors to do from the kickoff. And there's a specific introduction to governorship course, and there's also safeguarding, which is obligatory and very important, so that all governors who might be in and out of school and working alongside children understand the importance of keeping children safe. But there are lots of other modules, and these are all set up through county. So we have a web-based facility that we can access from both the county and, in our case, as a faith school, through our diocesan office. And they can be web training, they can be online, in-person group training sessions, and sometimes actually training sessions locally at a venue externally that might be sort of half a day or a day. But there's a whole variety. And as we go through our whole term as governors, we keep learning and we keep, you know, accessing new modules of training, because we may also take on different roles during our lifetime as a governor. My background was in marketing and PR, for example, and I'd also volunteered a lot in school. I was lucky enough to know a particular school well enough, but the finance side was all very new to me, and there are lots of specific courses about that as well.
Of course, of course. So, I mean, a really busy commitment. So how much time does it take up for somebody being a governor, and what would be a typical, well, let's say a typical month for a governor?
It varies. It's hard to say. But overall, we say we have, for the board as a whole, we have four what we call full governing board meetings a year. So they'll typically be 2-hour meetings in an evening where we all meet at school. And we also have a couple of subcommittees, and governors are generally at least on one of those committees. Some may be on two. And each of those committees, normally in our school, we meet once a term. So that would be another hour and a half, 2 hour meeting. But then it really depends on the roles. So we have what we call link governor roles, and we will each take responsibility for an area of the curriculum, a subject, and we liaise directly with the curriculum leader of that subject, whether it's maths or English and reading and or science. So once a term, we might pop into school and meet with the subject leader of that area and talk through their plans and talk through the progress the children are making. And then there are other visits we do sort of just to keep abreast of what's going on in school. We might visit for an assembly. There might be a special event where the children are doing a charity fundraising event in the playground, and we'll go along and support that. So it's really very varied. It's hard to put your finger on how much time exactly. But one thing I would say is that, you know, there is a minimal commitment, and there is also an understanding that whilst we aim to share the workload between the 14 of us as evenly as possible, there are equally some people who are more able to take up more responsibilities that involve just sort of time in the evenings if they're a full-time work. And there are others who might be working part-time or not working, where they can do more of the meetings or greetings even in school. For example, we also tend to attend, and again, we'll take turns, when we have open days for new parents and the staff and children are showing them around, it's always lovely to have a governor there that parents can talk to and ask questions of. And the same with parents' evenings, when the existing parents come in to talk about how their children are doing progress-wise, we'll normally have one or two of us there. So it's very varied, and it's hard to say exactly how much time that is. But as I say, you can give as much, not as little time, yet there is a minimum really requirement, but you can give as much time as you like.
Of course. And I'm sure, from everything you say, I can hear that it's fulfilling, and it's clear that it's fulfilling for you, being a governor. But I wonder whether there are more difficult moments sometimes. It can't be plain sailing the whole time. I'm sure that the relationship between the governors and the staff in the school, on the whole, I'm sure that goes wonderfully. But there must be times when it's tricky, and there must be times when there are tension. So are there those moments, and how do you deal with them?
Yeah, no, I think that the key thing is to try and remain as diplomatic as possible. And one thing that we really foster within school in terms of the children and across the staff and the governors and ideally with the parents as well, is that mutual respect. And however tricky the situation gets, I think building those strong and positive relationships so that you can have those difficult conversations sometimes is really key. And yes, it can be really challenging. I think in recent times, the pressures that have been put on schools financially and particularly post-COVID pandemic in terms of well-being, and that goes across the children and the staff, there's been a lot more concern about, you know, managing people's well-being because of the extra pressures in terms of workload and in terms of the needs of the children. So we've definitely seen a progression there. And it's one of the things that's the next actually that we're really proud of is our emphasis on well-being. And as I say, that cuts across focusing on the children and their mental well-being and having the support there and having those caring relationships. But also one of the things we hope to do as governors is support our staff if they are feeling, you know, that there's a lot of work going on, there's a lot of workload to manage and additional demands. So we have the staff themselves have a well-being team where they look after each other and focus on, you know, tea and chat and a listening ear for each other. And we also do that as governors. So we have visits into school where we'll just give some time to go in and have a drop-in session with staff so they can come and just unload to us. And sometimes there are practical steps we can help them to take or we can support as governors. And other times it's just being that listening ear. But I think it's the key thing with those challenging moments is being open to listening and being supportive and always being respectful, which is really key to us, I think.
Of course. Well, I can tell. I mean, fulfilling and challenging, demanding, time-consuming, nourishing, all of those things at the same time. And if people listening think that they might like to explore the idea of being governor a little bit more for them, not necessarily having a school in mind, maybe, or maybe they do. What's the best thing for them to do? What are the best next steps for them?
I think there's probably sort of two routes. If you are a parent or have a connection with any schools, then just approach them directly. Schools, as I say, are often looking for governors or will know that they're going to have vacancies shortly. Or just contact your local schools. You know, you don't have to have a connection through your own children or family or church. Or, as I say, diversity is the key. So it's lovely to have governors who are not directly connected in any way, but just have a vested interest in supporting a school. So do contact schools directly. They'll always be delighted to refer you to probably the chair of governors. They can give you a contact. Or go directly to the local council, either through the website or phone them, because again, the councils manage the schools, there'll be an education department, and they'll be able to, they will know as well if there are schools particularly looking for governors. So I would just approach directly and ask.
Excellent advice. Well, Lucy Powell, Chair of Governors at St Nicholas Church of England Primary School in Harpenden, hats off to you and all of your colleagues for everything that you do, and thanks so much for sharing that with us here on The Parents Show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Ian Pritchard talking to Lucy Parr, Chair of Governors at St Nicholas School, Harpenden. We'll take a quick break here on The Parents Show. We'll be right back, so don't go away.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome back to The Parents Show here on Mix 92.6. I'm Dave Neal. Continuing our theme of schools and education, a Boyne Lodge primary school in St Albans celebrates its 75th year this year, and Ian Pritchard was joined by Jennifer Sprinks, who told him how the school is planning to celebrate this milestone.
So joining me in the studio for the Parent Show today is Jennifer from the A Boyne Lodge primary school in St Albans. So welcome to Mix 92.6, Jennifer.
Thank you, Ian.
Lovely to have you. And I know that you're here to tell us a little bit about the celebrations that are going on at A Boyne Lodge and something special that's being done for that.
That's right. It's a really exciting year for the school. We are actually celebrating 75 years since the school first opened. So we have an exciting year of lots of different events that we're running. And one of them actually is trying to get the community's involvement. We're really trying to connect with the past and present as well of students, so teachers and students, and asking them to get involved by sending in some of their memories of the school. And we've already had quite a few people submit either their stories or their photographs, perhaps from when they were there. And we're going to be working with St Albans Museum in the centre of St Albans and looking at holding an exhibition where we're going to have a display cabinet and we're going to be showing off some of those photos and those stories as well. And in addition to doing that, we're looking at compiling some short stories along with photos and illustrations, as well as poems of their memories and the time that's, that they want to recall from A Boyne. And we're going to put them into a book called Tales of A Boyne.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. And so 75 years is this year.
That's right.
2025. Is there a particular date that this is all going to come together?
So we're going to be holding a summer soiree, I think. The date yet is to be confirmed. I think officially the school opened in the October. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a sort of a grey area on exactly when it opened because of different phases of the opening. But yeah, very much it's going to be in the autumn where we have, I suppose, a big hurrah. But in the summer, we're going to be holding a festival and a soiree as well.
Fantastic. And so you must have had lots of contributions already for the book. Any going back a long way, or have they all been in the last 4 or 5 years?
Oh, no, definitely going back a long way. And there's so many people who are recalling their time from the 60s and 70s. So and we have so many old photographs, black and white. We've got people who have told us stories about when they put on a show for Eric Morecambe. And we've had people writing about royal visits. So it's very exciting to hear this. And we're just trying to piece together all the different years and trying to have almost a timeline of all the different teaching heads as well that we've had.
Lovely. And how is the book actually going to be produced then? What will it look like when it's made?
It's a good question, because we're still at the stage of just seeing what we get in. And I'm really looking at getting more submissions for the book in terms of either poems, photos, illustrations, or short stories. They needn't be really polished. I'm going to be editing them on mm-hmm. behalf of the school, and then we're going to have a little team that's going to help format it and put it into a book with print. So really, in the next couple of weeks, we're really looking for the final submissions.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be looking at a foreword from the head teacher, and we're going to have an entry about the architecture, because it's a Grade 2 listed building and it's recently undergone renovations. So there's going to be quite a lot of different types of stories and content as well, talking about the history. There's a lot of history because it's built on an old orchard. So it's going to have quite a lot of facts in there, as well as some fun snippets from people. Some of the people are recalling stories about the days that they had old dark rusks along with a milk carton and how they got punished, you know. So it really fun stories as well, and some nice quotes. People have been commenting on social media. There are some people who maybe don't feel up to writing a story, but they maybe have some quotes that they're sharing on social media, and we'll be including some of those.
Excellent. And so when is the actual deadline for people to get stuff to you?
So if people get something to me, I'd say by the 15th of March, that would be ideal, because then what we want to be doing is trying to print it ready for Easter.
Yeah,
or soon after.
Oh, you're going to try and get the thing produced in time for Easter?
Produced soon. Soon. I've started looking at the content coming in. We're going to see what we get. And if it does slip a little bit, that's fine, because we've obviously got until the big summer celebrations, but we've got the display happening at the museum in April. Yeah. So we're keen to really try and also promote the book along with the museum work.
Gosh, that sounds like it.
It's a busy few weeks.
So say a little bit, Jennifer, about how you're going to curate all of that material, how you're actually going to put it together in the book. Because I imagine that some of it will be coming to you electronically, digital photographs and so on.
Yeah.
But other stuff must be coming to you in hard copy. There must
yes.
be actual physical.
It does make
material.
It trickier to be scanning them in. Mm. Some of the children have given some really lovely illustrations along with some very short poems. But we want to make sure we really retain how the originals looked. So as much as I'm going to be editing, I want to make sure I keep the real original tone and format as much as possible.
And have things changed over the last 75 years? I mean, obviously they've changed
yes.
quite a bit. What sort of things are you picking up from the material that you've been looking at is different now from how it was then, apart from the fact there was free school milk and dark rusks or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think generally in schools there's a bit of a softer approach now. Uh-huh. We're a bit more open to obviously different ways of learning. Mm. So some people did talk about maybe some of the ways that they, if they were naughty, what they might have had done, you know, nothing really terrible actually. They may be just told to sit in a particular area. But I think maybe we're a bit more gentle on that now generally in education. So some people, but they almost, even though they were recalling some punishment, they were recalling it in quite a humorous way.
Right.
And they still have very fond memories of the school. Mm. So it was still very much a very friendly, really, I suppose, a real community-based school as well. One of the things that we talk about the school is, our motto is creative, curious and caring. And I think those values really shine through. And it sounds like from some of the stories that are coming through, that's very much how it all began.
I'm sure. How big is the school now? How many?
It's just under 200, I think. Okay. It's very small because it's reception through to year six, mm-hmm. and we have anything from 20 to 30 students in a year group. So, yeah.
Lovely. And how long have you been associated with the school?
Well, my children are 5 and 8, so yep. I have one in year one and one in year four. Mm-hmm. And so quite a few years now, 4 years. So it's been great because I'm involved with the fundraising group. Obviously, funds and resources are really hard to get in for schools. So we do what we can as parents to try and get as much money as possible for the extra things that the schools can't really pay for. So it's been in things like the climbing frame, and we've had some of the teacher online resources as well, especially during lockdown time. That really did help many of the children. So it's the extra things, really. And it sometimes helps for families who can't maybe afford some of the school trips. We can then fund some of those. So it's really important fundraising. And partly this year, I wanted to be involved by helping with this book and commemorating 75 years. So it's a really big year for the school.
Of course it is. Yeah. And if people listening want to get in touch, find out a little bit more, maybe they say, well, I went there and I must have a photograph down the back of the sofa somewhere. How can they get in touch and how can they take part?
Yeah, really good. I would love them to look at the website, Aboyne Lodge Primary School, and to have a look for the reception email address. So if they could email the office and get in touch that way.
Okay, and that's Aboyne Lodge Primary School in St Albans.
That's it.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for coming in and talking to the Parent Show about that. Sounds fantastic. Can't wait to see the book when it's actually produced, and good luck getting it all together.
Thank you. I think I'm going to need that.
Ian Pritchard talking there to Jennifer Sprinks. As Jennifer mentioned, if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the 75th anniversary book, please contact the school reception through their website. Now, if you're a regular listener to Mixed Mornings, you might know that Ellie O'Mara on a Tuesday has regular contributors from Citizens Advice in St Albans. And this month, she was joined by Juan Nevado, a volunteer at Citizens Advice, who came in to talk about a project that he's been running in local primary schools about money management. Hear what he had to say to Ellie.
This month, we have got Juan Nevado. Welcome, Juan.
Good morning.
So actually, technically, it is Nevado. So, yeah, so there you go. And you are here to chat to us about money management and a project you're doing. But before we do that, I just want to hear a little bit about you. We've been hearing about your education, how you had an education in both Spanish and English. But tell us a bit about you and how come you are at Citizens Advice.
Okay, well, I come from a money background because I'm retired now, but I used to work in the city as a fund manager for a big UK institution.
Right.
I retired a few years ago and I decided that I didn't want to just sit on my hands after retirement, so I needed to do something. I looked around the charity sector and an opportunity came up at Citizens Advice because they do annual training for, normally they add about 10 or so volunteers to who they train on all the subjects that we try and help people with.
Right. So perfect background as well from the city to go into Citizens Advice. And the project that you're leading now is about money management, isn't it?
That's right. Because as people probably know, Citizens Advice does help people, grown-ups, not children.
Yeah, grown-ups typically.
We help people with debt problems, budgeting problems, housing issues, immigration, a whole series of issues. But obviously debt is a big issue, even in a wealthy place like St Albans. And so our chief executive, June Chapman, thought that it might be a good idea to think about a project where we're actually preventing debt problems.
Right. So that makes sense, doesn't it? As in, have we got worse with money? Do you? That's a question, isn't it? Have we, as adults, have we got worse with money and therefore we don't teach our children how to manage money very well?
I've always thought so because the school curriculum doesn't really cover money management well. If you talk to schools, they all say they do it in slightly different ways. And in fact, some of the feedback we've had from teachers that we've spoken to is that they wish they'd had a money management workshop like we've provided when they were at school.
So how does it work? Is it primarily aimed at primary school kids? Is that what the project does?
Yes, we focused initially on year fives and year sixes.
Okay.
So 10 and 11 year olds, because we think this is the really good age to start learning about money. I've discovered, for example, a lot of 10 and 11 year olds start having bank accounts. And so schools, it kind of rely on parents to teach their kids about money. But I think having something more formal like we've provided is really helpful.
It's a life skill, isn't it? So should we, in schools, I guess, why not teach life skills as well as your academic lessons as well?
That's right. It's always been a surprise to me that it isn't a formal part of the curriculum. And so if you look around the country, various charities and organisations do try to help schools with this, and we focused clearly on the St Albans district.
So tell us a little bit about the project and how you teach. How do kids learn? So I do know the answer to this. I know I'm priming you for this one, but literally everyone should know this. So how do children learn?
Well, when you're talking to 10 and 11-year-olds, lecturing them about money, like on interest rates and borrowing, is a bit boring.
Even for adults like me, I'm kind of, I can feel my eyes slightly closing as you started that sentence, Juan.
So we think the best way to do this is through games. And so we play a series of games which teach the kids about budgeting, bank accounts, interest rates, scams, loan sharks, risk and reward.
So, can you go through one of the games that you do? So that sounds fascinating, because I guess you kind of, you know, as a child, I've got Katie in the studio as well, so Katie may remember this. You might have played shops when you were a child,
or
you know, had a basket of stuff and you took it up there. You may have had a pretend till, but nowadays, you know, we're all tapping and we don't have cash in our purse to be able to count out and see how much we've got left. So just give us an example of like the kind of games that you get the kids to play.
Okay, so we start off the process, the workshop, by giving them, the kids, £500, and they get all excited when they hear, we've given you £500, and then we tell them, actually it's pretend money. And then we give them a little balance sheet, a piece of paper where you put a debit and a credit. And for example, one of the games is darts. So in a dartboard, there is an outer ring and an inner ring. We say to them, right, to play this game, you might want to, if you're really bad at darts, you might want to put your dart in the whole outer ring and it costs you £20, but you get £10 for every dart you go in. If you want to take more risk, you have to focus on trying to get your dart into the inner ring. The inner ring of the dartboard costs you £50. But you get £40 for each of the three darts that you get in. So this is a game where you're learning about risk and reward.
Right, yeah.
If you take low risk, you're going to get a low reward because you're going for the outer ring of the dartboard. If you take high risk, it costs you more, but you get a much higher reward if you get the dart into the inner ring of the dartboard.
Right. This is absolutely fascinating. So the project has been really successful, as in schools have signed up for it. You know, schools definitely want it. They think it's a really good thing. So that's it, the end of the project?
Well, we got funding, fortunately, last year from Harpenden and Building Society to do the project, because we need three members of staff at Citizens Advice to run the project. We did 20 classes of 30 children.
Wow.
And that's basically around 600 children we covered last year. And so the project was fully funded for last year, but now we're looking for funding for the coming 12 months. So we're going around institutions to see if we can get some money, because obviously we need to pay for our costs. And so we are actively going around seeing if other financial institutions can, or any other organization can come and help us fund this project.
Really, you've got a queue, haven't you, of schools who are going, we love it and we want it as well. And you would love to deliver it, I'm sure. I can see you're smiling at me, Juan, and I know you would be like, yep, we want to deliver it, but need more money to be able to deliver it.
That's right. We now have a waiting list, would you believe, of schools who have heard from other schools about the success of our project. And so we're keeping a tab of various new schools that haven't been covered. But obviously, before we can do anything, we need some extra funding. So we are looking for organizations, perhaps local organizations, who might be prepared to give us some funding for this project, because it does require three staff members from Citizens Advice to carry out the project, and we have costs.
Right.
And so we're actively looking for funding for the coming 12 months.
And so Harpenden Building Society, so big shout out to them because they supported the project previously. So that would be fine, wouldn't it? Any other building society, local business, if you want to help schools. So, I mean, we could appeal to the retailers on the basis that, you know, kids who grow up to manage their money probably want to, they'll have money to spend because they'll have managed their money properly. Is that a bit loose fun? Am I making that a bit?
That's right. We teach kids about, for example, debit cards and credit cards. We show them the borrowing is something that sometimes is a good idea for things that you need, but possibly not for things that you want.
Yeah.
So, you know, we show kids how, if you buy a computer game for £100, if you're paying 25% interest on a credit card, in more than a few years' time, you now owe them £300.
Yeah, so it costs more.
So learning about borrowing when interest rates are high is rather important.
Yeah.
So any retailer that might be interested in helping, you know, we'd be very happy.
Would be great. So all you need to do, just get in touch with Citizens Advice. So it is the St Albans branch because they are different charities. If you Google Citizens Advice St Albans, I always do it when I've got a member of the team coming on, which is once a month. I always have to remind myself. Just Google it. It comes up immediately. Get in touch with them and let them know how you can help. Juan, thank you very much for coming in and chatting to us about it. I think it's a brilliant initiative, and someone with a banking background can come in and just go, right, kids, you need to know about all of this stuff. So do it for the adults. We'd all pay you, I'm sure. I'm convinced of it.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.